Messenger of the Lord. Chapter 40. Understanding how the books were prepared. Sources seem to be employed more often to provide background and descriptive comment than for devotional and evangelical content. One is more apt to find Ellen White's independent comment in the moralizing or theologizing commentary. Some have wondered whether the expansion of Ellen White's original work on the life of Christ from approximately 50 small pages in Spiritual Gifts, Volume 1, to the 1,000 or more pages in The Desire of Ages, Christ's Object Lessons, and Thoughts from the Mount of Blessing was due to an extensive use of other sources. After 6 years of study, Fred Veltman, the author of the research study on the literary sources in The Desire of Ages, concluded that there was no evidence that the enlarged commentary on the life of Christ was due to a greater use of the sources. He readily saw that the broader treatment of the life of Christ, which included more narrative incidents, combined with the greater accumulation of material written by Ellen White through the years from which the finished product was compiled, easily accounted for the increased number of pages. Another question some have raised relates to who did the using of other sources, Ellen White or her editorial assistants, including Marion Davis. The evidence reveals that Ellen White herself utilized the sources which were brought into her published writings. No evidence has been found that Marion Davis or other assistants were responsible for the materials Ellen White adapted from other religious writers. Ellen White maintained extensive diaries or journals. Not only did she, generally, keep daily records, but often she amplified her thoughts, seemingly without any particular reason except to let her mind flow out on paper. These entries included both personal impressions and thoughts from her reading. At such times, without any attempt to organize under specific headings, Mrs. White copied or paraphrased those items from her extensive reading that she wanted to remember. From these journals, her editorial assistants would gather material for periodical articles. As time passed, many of these early jottings became part of her published books. Some of these copied or paraphrased materials were used not only in her book production but in letters, sermons, and even in expressing herself better in her diaries. On rare occasions, she used borrowed language to express thoughts directly impressed upon her in vision. To one accepting verbal inspiration, such borrowing and reporting of vision might be a problem, but not to one who recognizes that God's messengers relate inspired messages in words of their own choosing. W.C. White recalled that when his mother was actively engaged in preparing her Life of Christ, she had very little time to read. Previous to her work of writing on the life of Christ and during the time of her writing, to some extent, she read from the works of Hannah, Fleetwood, Farrar, and Geikie. I never knew of her reading Edersham. She occasionally referred to Samuel, Andrews, particularly with reference to chronology. Fred Veltman concluded that qualifying expressions such as minimal borrowing, wholesale borrowing, or references to percentage estimates are relative and imprecise terms. He believed that those who use such terms are either attempting to dismiss Ellen White's use of sources or are stressing the unusual amount of borrowing. Both emphases are misleading. It is more accurate to speak of her creative and independent use of her own writings and that of others than to minimize the amount of her borrowing. For those, however, who seek percentages of dependency, Veltman found that 31% of the sentences in the 15 random chapters he studied indicated at least one word or more of literary dependency. Deepening insights by a maturing prophet. Truth does not change, but a person's appreciation for and understanding of truth does. Even prophets experience a deeper understanding of truth as time passes. In his humanity, Jesus increased in wisdom and stature, and in favor with God and men. Luke 2 verse 52. When we study Peter's life, we have a clear picture of a maturing prophet after Pentecost. In 1906, Ellen White testified that for 60 years I have been in communication with heavenly messengers, and I have been constantly learning in reference to divine things, and in reference to the way in which God is constantly working to bring souls from the error of their ways to the light in God's light. Emphasis supplied. Mrs. White understood this human matrix through which the Word of God must pass in God's communication system. In her introduction to The Great Controversy, she alerted readers to the diversity of biblical writers, not only in style but in the unique insights of a writer who grasps those points that harmonize with his experience or with his power of perception and appreciation. When Mrs. White spoke of constantly learning, she was not thinking in evolutionary terms. that leaves God out of consideration, but rather a process of spiritual growth that is directly under the guiding hand of God. The same principle of growth is emphasized throughout Christ's parables and the New Testament epistles. The principle of growth underlies the wonder and excitement of the redeemed. The process begun on earth will be unending. As knowledge is progressive, so will love, reverence, and happiness increase. The more men learn of God, the greater will be their admiration of His character. The principle of growth affected Ellen White's ministry in two ways. 1. Prophets can lead people only as fast as they can comprehend instruction. This may mean that God will lead the prophet with His instruction only as fast as people would understand the prophet's message. Or, 2, God will speak to prophets only in terms that can be understood by the prophet. As prophets grow in knowledge, Christian discipline, and experience, their capacity to understand more about God's plans increases proportionately. In reference to Ellen White's central theme, the Great Controversy story, we have found an expanding, more insightful unfolding of that theme from 1858 to 1911, through the various publications as noted above. Something like a pencil sketch in 1858, the theme picture was outlined in about 219 small pages. The picture was filled in with further details in the larger, 1,600-page, 4-volume Spirit of Prophecy series. With the publication of the Conflict of the Ages series and its 3,757 pages, the sketch of 1858 had now become a four-color, 3D rendition of the original story. Do we find any evidence for the principle of growth in the mind of Mrs. White as she amplified the Great Controversy theme from 219 small pages to the present 3,757 full pages? Much in every way. But the deepening insights are not in conflict with the original sketch in 1858, only the filling in of details. Readers can make the study for themselves by comparing how Mrs. White described key people and events in each of the three renditions: Spiritual Gifts, the Spirit of Prophecy 4-volume series, and the Conflict of the Ages 5-volume set. For example, the expansion of thought, the filling in of details in Patriarchs and Prophets, and the Desire of Ages is dramatic. One senses no contradictions in the amplification, yet the expansion is profoundly compelling. The expansion of insights is not merely a matter of descriptive details. Clearer theological insights are apparent. For example, emphasizing the readiness principle, God seemed to wait until Seventh-day Adventists were ready for His prophet to speak more clearly about the deity of Christ. In both Spiritual Gifts and the Spirit of Prophecy set, little was said about the deity of Christ. But in Patriarchs and Prophets, 1890, and the Desire of Ages, 1898, Ellen White wrote clearly and in depth regarding the eternal preexistence of Jesus. This fresh emphasis became a distinct turning point for denominational thinkers on the deity of Christ. In her earlier writings, Ellen White reflected a prevailing Protestant understanding that emphasized God and His law in arbitrary, non-personal terms. If sinners are to be saved from the angry wrath of the Father, then Christ must die. The analogy of the courtroom, judge, eclipsed the analogy of the family, father. Although this early picture is correct in rough outline, both Patriarchs and Prophets and the Desire of Ages richly filled in the picture that added significant details to the traditional Christian interpretation of the atonement, most often reflecting Calvinistic thought. To move from picturing an offended God, who needed to be placated, to a God who was willing to endure misunderstanding and deception in order for His creation to see the awful results of rebellion, is a magnificent unfolding in understanding the central issue in the Great Controversy. Ellen White's growth in knowledge regarding practical duties and God's patience in waiting for her to be ready to understand visions that would unfold additional truths may be demonstrated by the following examples. For years she agreed with other Adventists such as Joseph Bates that the Sabbath begins and ends at 6 p.m. In November 1855, she had a vision that affirmed John N. Andrews's Bible study on the previous Sabbath that the Sabbath begins and ends at the setting of the sun. In 1858, she wrote Stephen Haskell that he was inappropriate in making an issue over the use of pork. After her vision in 1863, she made clear that pork was indeed a prohibited article. Note that in neither case was Ellen White contradicting light given to her in vision. As she grew older, she grew in knowledge. Visions, from time to time, when God knew she was ready, confirmed her Bible studies in such a way that fellow Adventists were impressed with her spiritual authority. What about plagiarism? The legal aspect of the charge that Ellen White plagiarized was reviewed by attorney Vincent L. Ramick of the law firm of Diller, Ramick & White, Washington, D.C. In his August 14, 1981 report, after spending more than 300 hours researching about 1,000 relevant cases in American legal history, he concluded that Ellen G. White was not a plagiarist and her works did not constitute copyright infringement / privacy. Ramick observed, "Nowhere have we found the books of Ellen G. White to be virtually the same plan and character throughout as those of her predecessors. Nor have we found, or have critics made reference to, any intention of Ellen White to supersede other authors in the market with the same class of readers and purchasers." Continuing, Ramick pointed out that Mrs. White modified, exalted, and improved the writings of others in an ethical, as well as legal, manner. Ramick came to his conclusions after many hours of reading Ellen White's books, as well as those used in her writing. Further, he read the material written by critics from D. M. Canwright to the present. He began his study with a prejudiced mind due to certain newspaper articles of the late 1970s and early 1980s. But he turned 180 degrees after reading her own books, those of critics, and case law. "It was reading her messages in her writings that changed my mind. I believe that the critics have missed the boat badly by focusing upon Mrs. White's writings, instead of focusing upon the messages in Mrs. White's writings. Mrs. White moved me. I am a Roman Catholic, but Catholic, Protestant, whatever, she moved me. And I think her writings should move anyone, unless he is permanently biased and is unswayable." When asked what he meant by message, Ramick replied, "The message is what is crucial. The critic reads a sentence and receives no meaning from it. He may, and often does, even take it out of context. But read the entire message. What is the author's intent? What is the author really saying? Where the words come from is really not that important. What is the message of this? If you disregard the message, then even the Bible itself is not worth being read, in that sense of the word." In response to a question concerning the ethics of Mrs. White in using materials of others without publicly stating where she got them, Ramick responded, after noting some legal precedents, "Ellen White used the writings of others, but in the way she used them, she made them uniquely her own, ethically, as well as legally. And interestingly, she invariably improved that which she selected. She stayed well within the legal boundaries of fair use, and all the time created something that was substantially greater, and even more beautiful, than the mere sum of the component parts. And I think the ultimate tragedy is that the critics failed to see this." Ramick found it interesting and absurd that, at times, critics charged Ellen White with plagiarizing books that she publicly urged her readers to get and read for themselves. And yet questions remain. Has the church been silent until recently regarding Ellen White's use of sources? Has anyone deliberately been trying to hide the facts? Would it have been better to have known this information through the years? Does proving that Ellen White did not violate plagiarism laws settle all questions regarding her integrity and authority as a divinely used messenger? Regarding the silence or hiding of facts, the record shows that the church through the years has attempted to convey the facts to its membership. However, for various reasons, the information either did not get out effectively or it was received with indifference. As in most other areas, it is always easier to look back and fault others than it is to help resolve present concerns. However, the record is not silent. At the 1899 General Conference session held at South Lancaster, Massachusetts, A. T. Jones summed up his remarks regarding Ellen White's method of writing. "There are statements that are true which God has led man to write. The spirit of prophecy, as manifested in Ellen White, picks out of surroundings that are not all true these gems of perfect truth, and sets them in the setting that is all true, so that they can shine in their own true luster." At the 1913 General Conference, W.C. White spoke clearly about many aspects of his mother's writing ministry, including how The Desire of Ages was written. W.C. White and Doris Robinson, representing the G. White estate, tried to explain what we all see more clearly today. In a 1933 document, Brief Statements Regarding the Writings of Ellen G. White, they wrote of how Mrs. White had been counseled by the Lord to seek out books that would provide gems of truth tersely expressed. Further, she had divine assurance that she would be guided in distinguishing the true from the false. In fact, they told how Mrs. White made no effort to conceal the fact that she had copied from other writers' statements that exactly suited her purpose. And in her handwritten manuscripts, most of the passages that she had copied word for word were enclosed in quotation marks. They then reviewed the printing process and noted. The question arose, how shall these passages be handled? Much time would be required to study each passage and mark it consistently. The printers were waiting for copy, and the public were waiting for the book. Then it was decided to leave out quotation marks entirely, and in that way the book was printed. We today would have given more attention to the use of quotation marks. Probably the lack of discussion among Seventh-day Adventists regarding Ellen White's indebtedness to certain literary sources was due, in part, to a lack of understanding of how inspiration worked, both in Bible writers and in the ministry of Ellen White. The prevailing concept among conservative Christians in the 19th century, as it is among many modern conservative Christians, was that prophets were verbally inspired and not thought inspired. To think otherwise probably never occurred to most ministers and church members. But only an unconscious half-step separates verbal inspiration from the greater error that inspiration means no human input, that the prophet speaks only divine words. Another reason was that earlier Adventists were living with the prophet. They heard her speak often, followed her instruction at key intervals in the establishment of most denominational enterprises, and were greatly blessed with her messages contained in their periodicals. Impact of message. For those who listened with open minds and hearts, their confidence in her ministry constantly deepened. It never occurred to most that contemporary sources, at times, were adding literary force to her writings. The impact of her messages was too compelling for them to think about the mechanics of how the messages were, at times, put into words. But what about those who, beside W.C. White, knew how the spirit of prophecy worked with the human prophet in finding appropriate verbal vehicles? These leaders, admittedly few, knew that verbal inspiration without the inclusion of human research is a mental and spiritual straitjacket. The issues that surfaced at the 1919 Bible Teachers Conference were fundamental, yet deeply divisive. The same issues had divided the Christian church for centuries. The question was not whether Ellen White was authoritative. The problem surfaced when church members were divided as to how to understand her messages when she was not available to explain her statements, or when her literary sources, at times, were discovered. Church leaders in 1919 knew that most church members, including ministers and teachers, had learned through experience to trust the messages of Ellen White, even though, at times, that trust was built on some unconscious variation of verbal inspiration. Knowing how divisive it was to discuss this subject even among Bible teachers and ministers, most leaders apparently hesitated to bring the whole church into the discussion. For the most part, they chose the practical way of putting their energies into evangelism and institutional development. The fruits of positive activity overshadowed the basic, even more practical, question of how prophets compose their human part in God's communication system. Deception was not intended. The immediate issue was denominational unity. Pastoral concern for the quiet trust and confidence that church members had for the writings of Ellen White overshadowed the academic time bomb that quietly ticked behind the energetic evangelistic activity. A potential problem developing. But did not the option of being pastoral and practical set up church leaders for the potential charge of cover-up? By avoiding a clear, wholesome discussion of how revelation/inspiration works, did they not plant the time bomb that would burst within the Adventist church in a future generation? When it is not made clear for generations that prophets do change with personal growth, that prophets do use other sources for bringing precision and force into their messages, rigid minds experience a terrifying awakening when the truth is brought forth. Assurance built on words and not the central message begins to collapse. The cover-up charge has affected church members in two ways. One, some who were avid supporters of their prophet have been shocked to learn that Ellen White used other sources in her messages. They have been shaken because they did not understand the process of revelation/inspiration. Two, people who were not committed to the basic messages of Ellen White have used her borrowing as one more reason to disregard her authority. This attitude is also the result of a misunderstanding of the revelation/inspiration process. Whenever anyone thinks in either slash or terms, many other subjects besides the process of inspiration will be misunderstood. The eventual awakening will be frightening. What, then, do we know about Ellen White's use of literary sources? Mrs. White read more widely, and enriched her writings with choice thoughts from her reading, more extensively than many were aware of. For those who think in terms of verbal inspiration, plagiarism aims at the foundation of their confidence in inspired writings. For thought inspirationists, plagiarism is considered from other standpoints, such as intent, fair use, quality of selectivity, and ultimate originality of the author's contribution. Mrs. White's use of literary sources is evident in almost all of her books. Her literary sources enriched all phases of her writing, including historical and geographical details, theological concepts, and even insights into extra-biblical matters such as activities of God, Satan, and the angels. By promoting books by Daubin and Coney Bear and Howson, it is obvious that Ellen White did not attempt to conceal her use of literary sources. Master, not the slave. Ellen White used literary sources to amplify or to state more forcefully her own transcending themes. She was the master, not the slave, of her sources. In her use of literary sources, Ellen White revealed her transcending ability to select those thoughts that harmonized with her theological principles while avoiding erroneous concepts. She did not copy wholesale or without discrimination. What she selected or did not select, and how she altered what she selected, reveals the overriding purpose in her broad reading. Mrs. White's main purpose in all her writings was to present a correct picture of God as seen through Jesus Christ, so that the way of salvation was not only clear but winsome. All her writings must be seen in the light of her primary purpose. Ellen White's later writings, especially as the Conflict of the Ages series developed, were more complete than her earlier writings. Apparent discrepancies exist, as they do in the Bible, revealing the human touch, but the larger purpose is always clear. Witnesses beyond number attest that in no case has anyone been misled by following Ellen White's counsel, when properly understood. Some may question the cogency of her reasoning at times that supports the counsel, but the counsel has always been sound. Neither Marion Davis nor any other editorial assistant was responsible for inserting into Ellen White's writings material adapted from her reading. The charge that most of Ellen White's writings, especially the Conflict of the Ages series, have been copied from others is false and without merit. A person should not lose confidence in either biblical writers or Ellen White because they did not receive all of their words directly from visions. This may be difficult for those who have previously thought in verbal inspiration terms, or for any who have had a more narrow understanding of how God communicates with his prophets. A prophet may quote from an uninspired source because of a certain insight that has particular value in enriching a prophet's message. However, the prophet's inspired purpose does not protect against possible error, such as in misstating a historical date. What about Ellen White's denials? We have seen in this book many examples of the human element in God's communication system, both in the Bible and in the writings of Ellen White. We have also seen a few instances that are not readily explained. Some have pointed to certain Ellen White denials regarding her use of contemporary sources as examples of duplicity. Others look at these examples in context and find Mrs. White void of deceit. Robert W. Olson, for 12 years director of the Ellen G. White Estate, summed up the focus on these denials by joining Fred Veltman's conclusion. It seems clear to me that Ellen White was worried over the danger of emptying the messages of their power through her dependence upon the writing abilities of others. In my judgment, it is basically this same burden of Ellen White's over the reception of her writings as messages from the Lord that led her not to fully disclose her dependence on literary sources. Olson listed 10 alleged denials, or non-admissions, made by either James or Ellen White, most of which presented no problem when seen in context. He concluded his article, "In my opinion, she did not want her readers to be distracted from her message because of concentrating on her method. Undue attention to how she wrote might raise unnecessary doubts in some minds as to the authority of what she wrote. If this is the correct explanation, let us not allow questions about methodology and inspiration to pull our focus away from the inspired communications God has sent us."